Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer. Today's podcast will feature one of the most beloved travel podcasters out there. He is Chris Christensen of The Amateur Traveler. He's been doing this for 19 years now, and he travels all over, tells about his adventures. He also interviews folks who are experts on different destinations around the world. But today, I get to interview him. So welcome back to the Fromer Travel Show, Chris.
Thanks. I don't know that I've ever been on before, as far as I can remember.
I thought you were on when we were a radio show.
Not that I remember, but just one small correction. I'm actually in the 21st year. I've done over 20 years of Amateur Traveler. So.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, even bigger congratulations then.
Thank you.
And one of the things you do that I used to do when we were on radio is you travel with your listeners. And not too long ago, you went to a place I've always wanted to go. I'm talking about Cuba. Wow. What a fascinating place that must have been.
It is. It is a little more complicated for Americans to travel to Cuba because of our restrictions with the Treasury Department's rules against traveling in Cuba. You can travel in Cuba these days, but you have to be on a people-to-people oriented trip, or you have to be visiting relatives, or you have to be in the press, or there's a couple other exemptions. And some of the things that means is you can't stay in anything that gives money to the Cuban government, which is all the hotels.
Yeah.
All the hotels and many of the restaurants. So it's easier. It's a lot easier to do it with a group trip that's already been approved by the Treasury Department and knows where you can go and where you can't go. Yeah.
So you took a trip with Intrepid. And as you said, you can't give money to the Cuban government. And so that meant you had very familial lodgings. Tell us about who you had to stay with to stay within the letter of the law.
Yeah, since all of the hotels in Cuba are owned, at least in part, by the government, you're staying in what's called a casa particulares. And so this is basically an Airbnb. And so it's someone who is renting out typically rooms in their home. So you're doing a hosted stay, and they may have one room in their home, or they may actually now have five or six rooms. And several of them have been doing this for more than a decade now and have been adding more and more services. So they add in solar because the power grid is very unreliable in Cuba. And so they're trying to make it nicer for their guests. But it's basically you're staying with locals, and they may or may not speak English.
Does it feel like a real Cuban home, or have these folks who have done it for a decade become so professionalized that it feels more like a small inn?
It depends, I would say. The place we stayed at, for instance, one of the two places we stayed in, Havana, because we started and ended in Havana, I'd say felt much more like a regular home. It was someone's home where they had some couple bedrooms available. I think they had three bedrooms available, and it was right downtown, very close to the Capitol building, very close to where things were. And you know, they serve you breakfast and such, and they spoke enough English that we had, you know, some lovely conversations with them. And it very much felt like staying with locals. I'd say one of the places that we stayed later on in a particularly tourist region, up where a lot of the Cuban cigars come from in Vinales, that one felt, I think I haven't been in a nicer Airbnb. So It was lovely place to stay. And it could easily have been someplace in the U.S. in terms of the quality of where we were staying. And they had definitely used a lot of the money to upgrade the house from, you know, when they had originally started doing it. We talked to them a little bit about that. The husband spoke English, so we were able to do that. So it depended a lot on where we were. And right. Also, and everybody in the whole group is not in one Casa Particulares. None of them were that big. And we had, I think on this trip, 19 people total, counting my wife and I. Right. And so because of that, you're off in four different directions when you get there. So it's an interesting experience. And yeah. Everyone is having a different experience. You know, this one, they didn't speak English, and this one they did. And this one, they brought the neighbor over who spoke some English. And so it was kind of potluck in terms of which one you ended up in. When you get to that destination, the guide would say, okay, you three couples are going over here to this one. And so very interesting.
That must have made it tricky to, you know, gather everybody to start the tours, because you were going around in a bus. And you said you had conversations. Mm-hmm. When you talked to them, did you feel like they had to be circumspect in terms of what they said about life in Cuba? Or do you feel like they were speaking in an unfiltered way? Because it is an authoritarian regime.
Yeah, but it's a regime that people are pretty much used to now, and they have their complaints. It wasn't like no one complained to us. In general, I would say we got the impression from our guide and from the people we met with that there are definitely things that are just broken in the Cuban economy right now. They blame a lot of that on the U.S. embargo. But as one person we met with said, well, we're in an island nation and we can't get fish. So we can't really blame that on the embargo. You know, we're importing sugar.
Do they blame that on
now.
Climate change?
No, it really is that a lot of the infrastructure is broken. So one of the things to understand is that with the Cuban people right now, there is a minimum wage in Cuba, but it's $20 a month, as I recall.
Wow.
And there's a maximum wage, which, as I recall, is $30 a month. And so some of the people who were doing these Casa Particulares, they were doing this now as their primary income, even though one of them was a dentist, but couldn't make a living as a dentist. So everybody basically is on government food stamps and everyone is on government support, because the economy isn't working that well. So a lot of people are getting their money here from the tourism business. Our guide was a former government economist who quit that job to be a tour guide because he can make much more money as a tour guide, and he makes it in hard currency. And so there's really kind of two economies. And if you can take part in the tourism economy, you're doing pretty well. You're doing okay. But if you aren't, we had people on the street in Havana who were trying to sell us, you know, here's my grandfather's sheet music that he had, because they're just trying to raise money. They're just trying to make a living.
Right.
It wasn't that. I love the Cuban people. It was a very great experience, but I wouldn't say that it convinced me to become a Marxist. It wasn't like you thought, gee, this is really working out all that well.
Yeah.
Part of the problem is that, you know, back when Russia was really supporting them, the Soviet Union rather was really supporting them, they really were relying on that money they were getting from them. And so their economy just doesn't quite add up. And so that's been good in the sense that it has forced the government really to open up more of these things where people can now run their own restaurant and people can now run their own Casa Particulares. And so we're eating, when I did a show on Cuba more than 15 years ago, I think, the joke was that in Cuba, the first three casualties of the revolution were breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Because if you wanted to get good Cuban food, they said you needed to go to Miami. And we found that not to be the case anymore, because at this point, there's sort of a separate hard currency economy. And we ate at a level, you know, number of lovely restaurants that were privately run restaurants. And the food was good. It was usually a fairly limited menu. Do you want the pork? Do you want the chicken? Do you want the steak? Do you want the lobster? And, you know, those are all the same price. So it was, it was good at this point. And that has changed in the last, over the last decade, as more and more relaxation of the economic rules have taken place in Cuba. So a very interesting place.
I read your blog and you said that not only was the food good, if not that, if there wasn't that much variety towards the end, you said, but you always got music with a meal. And I guess that speaks to how inexpensive the costs are there, that you can have a decently priced meal and a show.
Well, so remember, I said that there are people who are getting tourist dollars and people who are not. And so if you're a musician and you want to make a living, you're playing someplace where you're going to get tips from tourists. And so that's why there was always music, is this was an opportunity for those people who had those skills to tap into the tourist economy. So yes, every place we went, I think, not quite everyone, but it was surprising if you didn't have to talk over the band. And, you know, sometimes it was annoying, honestly, but the music was good and you know, the musicians were talented, and it was not like they expected a huge tip from our standards.
Right.
But,
right,
you know, that $5 I'm tipping or whatever is very significant for them. So, yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why it was so available.
Well, before we leave the crumbling infrastructure, something you wrote in your blog really hit home. I guess this is not the vacation to take if you need to be always in touch with the business that you're running at home. Because things just, the power goes, the internet goes, that's not reliable, right?
Yeah, we lost power. After we left Havana, we lost power every day. And it was just a question of how many hours you would lose power, because their power grid really is crumbling at this point. And so they're having difficulty supplying the power that they need. And again, a lot of the Casa Particulares had been doing this long enough that they had generators, or they had solar, or they had ways of getting you power even when the grid was down. Not everyone did, though. So some people in our group are in one that has the solar, and some people are in the one that doesn't. And then many of them also were having, you know, a Wi-Fi hotspot if they had the power to run that they could still connect. And some did, some didn't. But yeah, it was definitely one of those where you know, tell your business or your family or whatever, I may or may not be able to be in touch. So it had some challenges.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
And of course you can't get money out of the ATMs there, so you bring cash. And I ended up never actually trading in any cash into Cuban pesos. Actually, one change that's made, there used to be two pesos. There used to be the convertible peso and the non-convertible, and they changed that, I think, during COVID, around that time, where there's only one Cuban peso, and the official exchange rate you never exchange at, because it's ridiculous, but there's always somebody who will give you a better exchange rate, or you can just pay in dollars at many of the places we went to. And I ended up paying in dollars. Many people in our group did exchange pesos, but I don't know that you can always exchange them back. So that's a little tricky that way.
Oh, and then,
you know, you can't exchange them when you get back here either.
Right.
And so that's a little tricky that way, but it would be helpful to have a couple pesos for going to the toilet when there's the attendant or something like that. Yeah. So we would borrow some from other people who would exchange pesos. But
and you can't use credit cards. That's verboten.
You can't use credit cards. Yeah, because the bank system just isn't tied in. It's not allowed. The banks are not allowed to do business with Cuba. So yeah, your credit card will not work. So it's an interesting
very
place.
Different. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so you started in Havana, and you did get to ride in one of those classic 1950s automobiles. I think
a couple of them, actually, one convertible and one not. Yep, exactly.
Wow. So I think most of our listeners probably know why you do that, but just for those who don't, tell us a little bit about the cars in Cuba and what that was like driving around in this ancient vehicle.
Well, so honestly, I thought that this was going to be such a touristy experience, and I was all prepared to be high and mighty about it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. We were driving around in a 1955 Chevy. They're all bright colors. And of course, what's under the hood may no longer be a Chevy engine. It might be a Mercedes engine or whatever they can get. So there's a lot of entrepreneurial effort to keep these cars running. Because
they haven't gotten new cars since the embargo started.
There are new cars. There are not. It's not like all the cars are from the 1950s, which is kind of what our perception is.
Right.
But there are still these cars because they're not importing a lot of U.S. cars, obviously, but they do have connections to other countries. And so there are Mercedes there. There are Ladas even still around and some other cars from other places, Toyotas and things. But there are still this fleet of old U.S. cars because for many years, I don't think they were getting a lot of cars in it. And now at this point, of course, they're valuable. And so the person who was our driver had worked in the hospitality industry for years, and it was his grandfather's car. His grandfather had bought this car in the 50s, and then his grandfather had been a driver and his dad had been a driver, and now it was his turn. And he was clearly loving it. It was a way to make a living because, again, it tapped him into the tourist economy. And he loved his city and he loved showing it off to visitors. And because he spoke good enough English, he could tell us what we were seeing as we were passing. So he made a good tour guide. You know, not all the drivers were as adept at that, but he was doing what he loved and we were having a thrilling time just doing it. I don't know why, but it's really funny.
Yeah. And I was surprised that you went to a place where they discussed the Santeria religion. Because you think of classic Marxism, and there is no place for religion in that, if you look at what Marx wanted. So talk a little bit about that experience and what the religion consists of, how it intertwines with Catholicism.
Yeah, so this is something that is relatively recent that the government, I'd say over the last, I think it's 10 years or so, has relaxed some of the restrictions on practicing religion openly. And so Santeria is a Cuban-grown African roots religion that is, you know, and I'm not the Santeria expert. I can tell you what I understand and what I learned.
Of course.
But the idea was that as the slaves came over, they continued to practice some of their African religions, and they brought over these many different deities that they were used to worshiping. But then they associated them with different Catholic saints. And so the idea was that I'm worshiping on this saint's day and I'm going to mass in the morning. And then in the afternoon, I'm dancing, drinking rum and smoking cigars, which is how I would worship the local deity. And so whether it's a religion or a Catholic sect or a set of beliefs, depends a little bit on who you talk to. But there are, as you get inducted into Santorini, you have to abstain from anything that sounds like fun for a while, which includes sex and alcohol and other things. And then you enter into Santorini, and there's definitely secret knowledge, and there are people who will help you decide what you are going to do, who have, I would say, prophetic abilities within Santorini. And it was fascinating, but there was a local artist who made a community art space that celebrated in part Santorini. And so we went there and learned from some of the people who were both the artists as well as practitioners of this African-influenced religion.
So then after exploring the capital. You went into the interior, where you did a look at small local farms, including, of course, tobacco farms and those who grew tobacco for the famous Cuban cigars. Tell us a little bit about Cuban cigars.
Sure, sure. Well, and the area you're talking about that I went to is the Valley of Viñales, and this is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And if you've never seen a picture of it, it reminds me of the mountains in Avatar. It is a beautiful, beautiful region with these karst mountains that stand up there. It's a very green region. And I didn't know what to expect because, you know, I'm thinking I'm going to a UNESCO World Heritage Site and we're going to go on a tour. I didn't quite get the idea that part of what they're preserving here, UNESCO is preserving, is the farming community, is the ways that they farmed there. And so our tour of the UNESCO site was a tour of these farms. And particularly the idea behind the tobacco is interesting because all tobacco products produced in Cuba, the government gets the first shot at the tobacco. So the government buyer comes out and he purchases at a very minimal rate, 90% of your crop. And that's it. If you grow tobacco, the government gets 90%, and they use that to produce a lot of the cigars that they sell and they use to support the Cuban economy. It's a very important export for them. And then the rest of this, though, you are allowed to produce your own family-grown, family-raised cigars. And so they told us all about the different types of tobacco leaves. There's sort of, if you think of a tobacco plant, the ones that are closer to the sun, the top of the plant gets stronger, and the ones that are lower down are more mild. And so you can mix different flavors of tobacco depending on how strong it is. And then you grow the outer leaf in a separate field under cloth so that it remains more flexible. And then
so when you say the outer leaf, that's the one that you roll
that's the
wrapping
cigar
one. In.
You're rolling it in. See. Exactly. The other thing that's different is the government cigars are just basically harvested, dried, wrapped, sold. And the ones that are grown by the local farmers are first soaked in something and fermented, which I did not know was a step. I'm not a cigar smoker. Yeah. And so they said these are the better cigars anyway. And then they're wrapped and they're cut in different ways, and you can buy them there for something like, you know, $5 a cigar, depending on which level of quality or what style or whatever. They'd get a little more expensive. But first they'd show you all this. You're just in this, you know, relatively small farm. As someone who grew up with agribusiness, with, you know, huge farms, this is not that. This is a lot of the farming there. In fact, they're not allowed to use tractors in this valley because of the preservation of it. And so we saw people plowing with oxen, which I remember that my great grandfather in Nebraska was with the last people there to plow with oxen. So for me, it was like a little bit of a time warp here.
Incredible. At $5 a cigar, though, with a population that's only making $20 a month.
Oh, very
important.
Does this
mean only tourists are actually smoking Cuban cigars, or do the Cubans get a different price?
Or they're getting it from their friends and they're exchanging, you know, I'm sure that there is a different, again, there's two economies, really. There's the tourist economy and then there's the local economy. And so you might be bartering that for somebody else for something that your family is going to eat, or you might be giving it to your friends or whatever. But yeah, it's probably not something that most people can afford.
Did anyone in your group try the fermented cigars?
And
say about it?
People definitely bought some. Now you're not allowed to import them back into the U.S.
But so they smoked them there, so probably okay. And did they taste a difference or feel a difference? I'm not a smoker, so I don't know. If you taste it or
I don't know
it.
That we had anybody who was a regular smoker, so I don't know that there was anyone who said, oh my gosh, that really tastes so much different. But
interesting. Okay. Yeah. So you went to the cigar farms, which sounded pretty amazing. But as you were driving around,
the crumbling infrastructure played a role. You went over potholes. They constantly were having to rejigger the tour because, you know, you would get a flat tire or you'd have to wait an hour for gasoline.
We did. Yeah.
So what would that do to what you did on the tour?
Well, so the flat tower obviously was not planned. The waiting an hour for gasoline was more normal. And so that was just something they built into the tour that we're going to go drop you off at this private golf club. And you're just going to sit around for an hour so you don't have to just sit in the bus while we go and wait in the line for the gas. But yeah, it's something that they just have to build into the timing. But yeah, the flat tire was unanticipated and we did lose some time on one day on one of our long drive days. But
now I know that legally in the United States for a tour to be within the letter of the law, you have to be learning about the Cuban people when you take this tour. It has to be an educational experience. And yet you guys did get to lie on the beach a little, right?
We did one day. So yeah, those beaches are not disallowed. Although even that was a fascinating day because so we're you know, out on the beach where we've rented a beach umbrella as one does, and we're getting our mojitos or whatever from the local beach bar, but we're waiting in the surf and a fellow walks up and asks in Spanish, "Do you want a lobster?" And he's got a net with lobsters in it. And a couple of people say, "Well, sure, I'll take a lobster." And he takes them back down to his fire pit and cooks the lobster over the barbecues, the lobster over the fire and gives them a fresh lobster. And so even that was a interesting cultural experience. This is something I've never had happen to me at any beach in California or any of the New Jersey beaches, is people walking up to me with fresh lobster that are still moving.
Amazing.
But yeah, you talked about it has to be a learning experience. Everyone also has to keep a diary. Everyone has to keep a journal. And
did people enjoy doing that or did they think it was a pain in the rump?
I didn't hear any complaints, but I've got a good group of listeners. You know the listeners of your show, right? They're smart, they're interesting, they're adventurous. So I didn't hear any complaints for that. But in theory, the U.S. government could ask to see your diary for up to 5 years, I think it is, or your journal. But you have to, you know, show that you are learning. Now, of course, for you and I suspect you, like I also already have your notes that you're going to use for, you know, whatever you're going to produce.
But that's interesting. I always feel a little blessed that I have to always create a story from where I'm going, because I personally feel when you travel with a mission in a certain way, it makes the experience richer. Mm-hmm. And so this might have actually elevated the experience for the folks there.
It also means, you know, I don't know about you, but there are trips that I think, now, what did I do there? I just go back to my blog post or whatever, or go back to the podcast, because you can't always keep track all of the different trips that you made, especially if you're going back to a country multiple times, you know, which trip was that on and what did we do there? I find it very useful to have those. And we actually kept travel journals before I was doing any sort of travel journalism. My wife was doing that before I married her. So that is, we still have her travel journal from, you know, her spring break trip in college, which was before we started going out. So
now, before I let you go, maybe for our Canadian listeners who can go wherever they want in Cuba, it sounded like Trinidad was the highlight. Just the photos there were spectacular. Trinidad seems to be the place where they really are getting into the architecture and the art and the history of the country, maybe with Havana, but Trinidad, on your blog, the photos were just extraordinary.
It is a pretty city. For me, I would actually probably say Viñales, but Trinidad was another highlight. You're in Trinidad, you're learning more about the sugar mill history because this was a sugar city. This was a city that was built on sugar. And so you have these old mansions of the sugar barons who were making their money on sugar. And of course, slavery, which was what was at first, you know, providing the power for all of those things that you were doing in terms of making the sugar. So yeah, Trinidad was lovely. And Trinidad is where we did the beach too. So if you're looking for that kind of thing, it's certainly an area that I would recommend. Yeah, it would be hard to say. Havana was also so special too. So one of those three was the highlight.
One of those three. Yeah. Well, you brought Cuba to life. Absolutely. It was a delightful blog piece to read. And you bring the whole world to life on your podcast. So thank you so much for appearing on the Frommer Travel Show.
Well, it's only fair. You've been on my show a couple times talking about New York City. So
Absolutely. All right. Well, that is it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.